I'm Joyce Moy, the Executive Director of the Asian American Asian Research Institute here at CUNY. And we are so pleased to be able to co-host and sponsor today's event, the launch of the Women's Study Quarterly, the Asian Diaspora edition. So first, I'd like to thank all of the folks that have been so helpful in putting this together. And that includes the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, and particularly Helen Foster, who is the Executive Director, and she's been terrifically supportive of this. But I'd also really love to give a special shout out to Marianne McKenzie, who has been not only behind the scenes, but on the front lines in making sure that we get these the kinds of things done, because diversity and inclusion is so important to the City University. I'd like to invite Marianne to come up to say a couple of words on behalf of Helen Foster, but I can't tell you what an amazing colleague she is. So thank you so much, Marianne.
It's such a joy for me to be here. And despite the fact that Helen Foster is not with us today, she does send greetings, and I'm pleased to be able to share her remarks with you. Good morning and welcome. Thank you for giving CUNY's Office of Human Resources and the Office of Recruitment and Diversity the opportunity to host you at 395 Hudson Street for the celebratory launch of the special issue of Women's Studies Quarterly, Asian Diasporas, co-sponsored by ARI and Women's Studies Quarterly. I'm sorry that I could not be here personally today to welcome you and to also participate in, I know, will be a very terrific day. I'm currently in Washington, D.C. on my annual trip to my alma mater, Howard University. It is a time for me to reflect, renew, and recommit with the people and the institution that was instrumental in my development into the person who I am today. If I may take a point of personal privilege to shout out to certain people, as the young people would say today, I would like to give a shout out to LaGuardia's Professor Natalie Havlin, who I met on my third day at the City University of New York at the joint meeting of the University Advisory Council of Diversity and the Chief Diversity Officers. Although she's on sabbatical currently, she's with us today, I'm pleased to point out. But she did leave UACD in good hands with LaGuardia's Professor Andy Kaitron Chuang as her replacement. I would also like to give a shout out and a thank you to Baruch College's Professor Shelley Eversley, who educated me on the value of the Faculty Fellowship Publication Program and made me a true believer in the excellent work that they do. Kingsborough's Professor Lily Shee also gets a shout out, even though I've not personally met her yet. She's a former FFPP Fellow and one of the editors of this issue on the Asian diaspora. And my last and largest shout out is to Executive Director Joyce Moy. Thank you for your steadfast commitment and to everything you do for CUNY, for ARI, for UACD, and for the entire Asian diaspora. Again, welcome today. I wish you a very successful event. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marianne, for delivering Director Foster's message. And again, thank you so much for all of your support and help with this. So now I'd like to introduce one of the Dynamic Duel, member of the Dynamic Duel, the co-editors of this edition that we're launching today. And she'll be introducing some other folks and telling you a little bit about today's event, and then we'll proceed from there to our first panel.
Thank you, everyone, and good morning. And a shout out back to Director Foster. I did not know she's a Howard alum. I got my PhD from Howard University. Love a shout out back to her. I hope our paths cross, you know, soon. So I'm Lily Shee. I'm Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Kingsborough College of CUNY. And I am one of the co-editors for this special journal, issued Asian Diasporas of WSQ. Yadira is my co-editor, and she lives in Australia, stationed at the University of Melbourne. Unfortunately, because of time zone travels and funding issues and childcare challenges, she cannot be here with us today. But she sends us her warmest regards, and she's with us. She was still texting me at 3 o'clock in the morning. So she's virtually with us today. I'd like to open up with my many thanks to different groups and different people to open up today's event. First of all, to Ari and to Joyce Moy. Without her, this event is not possible. I was telling everybody I can't even organize my daughter's four-year birthday parties, not to mention an event so elaborate like this. Impossible. I was just panicky the whole time. But she did, and Anthony also shout out, immediate responses on email, midnight. In the past few days, it really is hands-on. So without their hard work, this event is not possible. My thanks also goes to CUNY Central, the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, to Director Foster, and also to Marianne here, and also to WSQ and the Feminist Press for giving us this space and opportunity to explore the possibilities how we can foreground gender when theorizing Asian diasporas. And I'm actually really proud to say here that this is the first time this longest running, mainstream, one of the most historical women's studies journal spotlight and explicitly orient to ethnic studies and exploring gender and women's studies. And against this dominant black and white racial relationships in the United States. So we're very happy about that. And as you can, the room is yet to be filled up, but the funny story, I'm very proud. I was surprised that Wednesday night, I forgot to register for myself for the event. So I tried to do that and it was all sold out. And I was so surprised, the space of 120 all sold out by Wednesday night. So judging from that outcome, that enthusiasm, I think this is a very needed issue as well. Jillian is right here. This morning there were some accidents with NJ Transit, so we have several contributors, participants got delayed, but my thanks goes to Jillian Baez and Natalie Howland, who are the general editors of WSQ. And especially to Jillian for inviting me to join the board of WSQ in the fall of 2017. The community and the intellectualism and the birth of this issue are all proven to be the most significant moments of my career and also YetDR's career. And next, and most importantly, my warmest thank you to the authors for your marvelous work, your patience and your time, and above all for coming here today to be with us. I can't wait to hear all of your work and chat with you personally during breaks today. And then finally, lastly but not least, to our audiences who made time to come, and particularly those who contributed namelessly throughout the production procedures of this issue. A lot of you here participated in significant and meaningful ways. Linda, for example, organized the Building Asian American Studies Summer Institutes across CUNY. She's one of the four organizers. And because of that, this issue is very much kind of inspired by that. And because of the network we built through the Summer Institution, the people that I got to know contributed to the issue, volunteered to review for the issue, read my drafts of the introduction. So all these, nameless labors were actually there throughout the entire issue. A lot of you probably know already, I had a baby during the process of this issue. The production of that human being synced exactly with the production of this issue. He is 15 months now. And, thank you all so much for sitting here, for taking me out to lunches and, hearing me vent and texting me, in the middle of the night. That kind of labor and therapy was very much needed to sustain me throughout the process and made this particular issue possible. So thank you so much. You made this so meaningful. And without further ado, Jillian is here. Let's invite Jillian Baez, the general editor of WSQ, for a few words.
here. I have to admit this was quite a journey to get here. That involved finding a number of circuitous routes to get here from New Jersey, despite like the path being down and New Jersey Transit. So I'm just so happy that I'm here just in time. And I very much feel that that's often like how our production process is for the journal, right? Everything comes in just in time, a number of challenges, and somehow the collaborative process, it all gets done. So I want to thank all of you for joining us today at the launch event for this most recent issue of WSQ, Women's Studies Quarterly. I want to tell you a bit about the journal, and then I want to tell you a bit about why this issue is so important to us. Published by the Feminist Press at the City University of New York, WSQ is the oldest peer-reviewed feminist journal in women's and gender studies. Since 1972, WSQ has been an interdisciplinary forum for the exchange of emerging perspectives on women, gender, and sexuality. We release two double issues each year that are thematic, combining social, political, legal, queer, cultural, technological, and historical work to present the most exciting scholarship on ideas that engage popular and academic readers alike. Along with scholarship spanning across various disciplines, and often interdisciplinary pieces themselves, WSQ showcases fiction, creative nonfiction, poetry, and the visual arts. When my co-editor Natalie Havlin and I embarked on our journey as general editors of the journal, one of our main goals was to expand the scope of the journal to foreground transnational feminisms and continue to push the field beyond the black-white binary in multicultural feminist theories. We were very pleased when Lily Shi approached us about her ideas of centering an issue around Asian diasporas. The resulting issue offers a multiplicity of perspectives through which we can understand Asian diasporas as gendered in terms of migration, displacement, cultural hybridity, inter-ethnic relations, activism, citizenship, and a number of other areas of study. Movement to, from, and across Asia is not new. Asian diaspora communities can be found all over the globe, including Africa, the Americas, Europe, and Australia. It is also not uncommon for Asian migration to be marked by multiple migrations over the course of a few generations. This constant movement can ferment feelings of nostalgia and loss, which not only the pieces in the issue discuss, but also the cover very much is a piece that deals with that theme. But migration can also be the catalyst for new forms of kinship, creative, hybrid forms of expression, and the reinvention of urban, suburban, and rural spaces. This issue of WSQ taps into the varied experiences of Asian diasporas across the globe through an intersectional optic that views gender and sexuality as central to the process of migration. The label Asian encompasses a heterogeneous group of people with varied histories of colonization, both as the colonizer and the colonized, spoken and written languages, and cultural practices. The push and pull factors for migration also differ among Asian groups. As you know, while some migrate for more economic opportunities, others leave for political refuge. U.S. policy also shapes Asian migration. For example, the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act in the U.S. and the 1923 Chinese Immigration Act in Canada both restricted immigration from China until the 1940s. During World War II, Japanese internment in the U.S. cast East Asians as not only second-class citizens, but also as enemies. These policies and practices cemented the images of the perpetual foreign other in the popular imagination. As a result of the passage of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, Asian migration to the U.S. soared to the thousands, but Orientalist discourses continue to circulate in the U.S. and Europe. U.S. military intervention in countries like Cambodia, Grenada, the Philippines, and Vietnam also greatly influenced Asian migratory routes and patterns to the U.S. and other parts of the world. As such, militarization and colonialism remain a central part of the Asian diasporic experience. While certain Asian groups are considered model minorities in Europe and the U.S., this framing is uneven. For example, Cambodians are one of the poorest communities in the U.S. Additionally, while Asian migrants might be valued for certain kinds of gendered labor, for example, Indian men in the technology industry or Asian Pacific women in domestic work, they are not always welcomed into mainstream society. In addition to facing centuries-old Orientalism, contemporary Asian diasporas exist in countries that are increasingly hostile to immigrants, particularly in Europe and the U.S. Ironically, Asian consumer products and practices, like Korean skincare, matcha tea, and yoga, are routinely co-opted for U.S. consumption, but Asian migrants are not necessarily welcomed. For example, Chinatowns exist globally, but some merely exist for consumption of non-Asians, with few Chinese people actually living in those areas. This issue reaffirms WSQ's commitment to transnational feminisms. Over the last 10 years, WSQ has published a number of pieces that examine gendered and queer experiences of immigrants across the world. However, Asian diasporas is the first issue to focus exclusively on issues of migration on a global scale. Beyond WSQ, it is rare that diasporas are studied outside of an Africanist or Jewish framework. The academic and creative works in this issue carefully weave together multiple narratives and ways of understanding gendered Asian diasporas. Most of the pieces in this issue theorize what feminist media studies scholar Angela Valdivia calls the pains of hybridity. In an attempt to make sense of experiences of loss, discrimination, belonging, community, and affirmation. As we currently experience a global humanitarian crisis for refugees, this issue urges us to revisit the root causes of migration and how diasporas process grief, memory, and kinship in new spaces. I want to emphasize, and you know, Lily spoke to this just a little bit, that this issue was a transnational endeavor that required communication between authors and the editorial team across the country and abroad. On behalf of Natalie Hamlin and myself in our roles as the WSQ general editors, I thank guest editors Lily Shi and Yadira Perez Hazel for their vision and patience in coordinating many authors and editors across various time zones and places. We thank WSQ's creative editors, Rosalie Morales-Kearns and Patricia Smith, for their editing the prose and curating the poetry, respectively. We're especially grateful to WSQ's editorial assistant, Elena Cohen, for shepherding the logistics of the issue from beginning to end. We also thank WSQ's social media coordinator, Kirsten Cornielsen, for promoting Asian diasporas online. We also appreciate the tremendous support WSQ receives from the feminist press, and I am told to remind you that the feminist press will be here today to sell issues of the to sell copies of the issues. So please look out for them. We also extend our gratitude to the WSQ editorial board for providing early feedback about the significance and direction of the issue. This includes the late Nina Alexander, who passed during the production of the issue and is honored in a short essay at the end of this issue. Again, thank you so much for joining us today, and I look forward to hearing about the intellectual exchanges in all of the events organized for today.
Let's go ahead and start our first panel. Our four panels today are loosely based on the chapters, the sections in our special issue.
Good morning. My name is Anita Batch. I'm a faculty member in the English department at LaGuardia Community College. I'd also like to thank Lily and Nadira for putting together the journal issue, Feminist Press, ARI, and other sponsors of the event. And I'd like to thank Natalie Hamlin as well, my colleague at LaGuardia, for encouraging me, especially with doing this piece. I, for this issue, interviewed Sukun Teresa Way, and I want to talk a little bit about how I came to her work. Since this is an interview, it's a little different from the other pieces. So I actually want to backtrack a little bit before. There's a long backstory to me kind of coming to this work, and that's what I want to talk a little bit about today. So I also participated in that awesome NEH at BMCC, called Building Asian American Studies Across Community College Classrooms, and that's where I met Lily as well, and some other folks, and I'm grateful to the organizers, Sonia Munchi, Carolyn Hong, Linda Varghese, Jennifer Hayashida, because through that work, I really started to think about Asian American studies in general. I do work on Indians in the Caribbean, and so it really expanded my knowledge and my conceptualization of Asian American studies. So in that seminar, I read Eric Tang's Unsettled, which examines Cambodian refugee resettlement in what Tang calls the hyper-ghettos of the Bronx. And we went for a teaching tour to visit MeCon NYC, the nonprofit in the Bronx. And so I feel like, in some ways, my coming to Sixburg and meeting her was really divinely orchestrated because I had done all of this before I met her, and I met her in a way that was not connected at all to the seminar. So I met Sook through a colleague, Abia Abdul-Mata, at LaGuardia when Sook came to visit her creative writing class to do a workshop for students. And so Aaliyah knew that I was teaching Asian American literature, and she knows my interests, and she invited me to sit in on the class. And so I was able, luckily, to see this workshop with Sook, and that's how we met. And so during the workshop, I admired Sook's ability to connect with students, sharing how her life influenced her poetry, and getting students to draw on their own experiences to create kitchen talk poems. Poems based on their perceptions of their kitchens. At least that's what I remember from sitting in the workshop. And I was just really taken back at how Sip just came in, just instantly the students just connected with her because of her presence and what she shared with them. And she got them to easily share with her, and that was like amazing. So she had met them for the first time, and so I was very impressed. And so after this, I bought Apsara in New York, which had came out recently, and I instantly fell in love with the work. I felt the depth and passion of the poetry, laughed at the humor, and made connections between the poems and Tang's work with MeCon NYC and my conversations with Sook. And I particularly love the poems that portray recurring images of the Bronx, of being Asian American, of being an Asian American young woman in NYC in the 1980s and 1990s, and the complex relationship between mother and daughter, and the everyday struggles of the Asian American laborer. Sook's work makes her labor and body and thoughts visible in a world that renders her invisible. I thought Apsara in New York, and I taught Apsara in New York in my Asian American literature class. I'm teaching it again this semester. And invited Sook to speak at LaGuardia in the following spring. When I came across the call for papers for the special issue for WSQ on Asian diaspora, I saw it as an opportunity to speak to Sook more in depth about her process. I'm grateful to her for sharing generously and openly. Our interview process was deep, it was fun, it was special because of the ways in which I've been able to connect with Sook through her writing and friendship. So we're going to read a little bit from the interview together. So I'm just going to read. I'm going to read the question, and then Sook's going to answer through what we wrote here. As an Indo-Caribbean American woman and immigrant, your work resonates with my own lived experiences, with my research of Indo-Caribbean writers and artists. I'm particularly drawn to your exploration of gender, Asian immigrant experiences, the dynamics with Asian diasporic families, and legacies of trauma. One concern of this WSQ issue is exploring how gender intersects with the politics of belonging. Do you see these tensions playing out in your poetry?
It's so strange being in an interview that you did. In the Persona poems, which are written in the accented voice of a Cambodian woman, the fact that she even gets a space on the page in that voice, it was unintentionally a political act. But the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to not just include that voice, but really emphasize it and highlight it. For example, I don't use strange spellings to accentuate or hyperpronounce her words. She's allowed to exist on the page. She matters. This is a woman most people wouldn't even look at twice. She works in a hotel, she cleans rooms, she says the same words in English every day. Hi, how are you? Or, you know, have a good day. Yet she's already aware of her status, of her class, of her racial and ethnic background, and where she is in the social stratosphere of the hotel industry, working alongside Caribbean Americans and other immigrants. There are a lot of women present in Apsara, New York. It was not something I had tried to do. I was just writing what I was thinking about at the time. I'm a feminist, but I'm not a loud feminist. I'm not a pink pussy hat feminist. By the way, I really didn't appreciate seeing one of those hats on the statue of Buddha, which I saw recently online, as though that was supposed to be revolutionary. If anything, it was representative of how a lot of work is within intersectionality and white feminism. As a woman of color, a woman who came here under duress, that's something I'm constantly exploring because it took me decades to realize I lived a different experience. The more I write, the more I understand why I feel always a bit off wherever I go. At first, I thought it was being Cambodian, and then maybe it's because I'm from the Bronx, maybe it's because I grew up in the projects, maybe it's because I grew up in, before it was rezoned, the poorest congressional district in the country. Maybe it's because I came here as a refugee and I didn't choose to be here. We didn't have the resources. Every time I add a new label, it starts to narrow my things down more, but I enjoy the specificity of knowing these factors that contribute to who I am and write as.
The issue of language and culture you mentioned also arises in your collection. A line from Trespass reads, "Every English word is a betrayal of our past." Could you elaborate on this?
That line was written in a poetry class. I was thinking about my struggle with trying to speak Khmer. That's the official language of Cambodia. So I speak Khmer now versus when I was younger. When one is spoken to in Khmer by an elder, one must respond in Khmer, especially juniors. Otherwise, there's an accusation of not being Cambodian. It's not an unusual thing in immigrant communities, and I know that we're not able to have this association between heritage, language, and identity. But I felt that with every English word I learned, I was turning my back on my family and my heritage. Turning my back on my family, my heritage, my ancestors, my country, my birthright, that I haven't done right by my people because my daughter doesn't speak Khmer. So even as I try to write to bring attention to my people, what we've been through in our country, the fact that it's not in Khmer sadness. Part of it is that we don't have access to learning Khmer the way you can learn Chinese. You can learn Thai and Vietnamese with Rosetta Stone. Khmer is not a commerce language. No one needs to know it to make money aside from people in Cambodia. But I said to my daughter, don't let anybody ever tell you you're not Khmer. You don't have to speak it in order to be Khmer. That's something that's born within you. And sometimes I wish I was as kind to myself as I am to my daughter.
Thank you.
One thing that's actually really special about Falk is she's featured as the interviewee in this particular beautiful piece that she collaborated with Anita, but also at the same time, her creative piece, a short story, Facebook Mama, is also included in this issue as well. So hopefully we're going to stay in the afternoon as well.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So she's going to stay with us, and we have a creative panel to, you know, for all the creative writers to read their work in the afternoon, and she's going to be here with us together.
Oh, and also let me just say that my full name is Sukunteri Svay, or Sukunteri Svay, the you know, anglicized version. You can call me Silk.
I mean, so is there anything, you know, this was done quite a few months ago, the interview, right? So, at this moment, looking back, are there anything that you feel like you did not say or you wanted to add to this particular question?
Oh, I don't know. I feel like it's hard to write these, to be a part of these things, and because it's never going to be definitive, right? And then, you know, it's kind of like, you know, revision. You can always revise, you can always add to that. And I'm constantly revising myself.
I'll let you know. I feel like it'll come up.
Okay. Thank you, Nini, for that introduction. To the editors, to Feminist Press, to all of the other contributors, and for everyone who's here sharing space with us this morning for the rest of the day. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about my work, my relationship to this work, my writing, and sort of some of the more community engaged work that I do that inspired this piece in this special issue. So my research underscores the intimacies of home in shaping our political lives. The more time I spent in Manhattan's Chinatown over the years as a cultural organizer, the more often I found myself asking these questions.
Right. What are the political consequences of perpetual awkwardness? What can encounters of displacement tell us about the political possibilities inherent within immigrant communities? And how can I, train as a political scientist, right, create space for a kind of research that's rooted in the social material conditions of a place called Chinatown that my mother and thousands of others have once or now call home? So in many ways, these questions are deeply political and personal for me and have allowed me to learn more about my own relationship to displacement. My mother's family is from the heart of Shanghai. Everyone grew up in what was called a longtang or longdang in Shanghainese. It's an alleyway neighborhood common in parts of urban China. And so in the mid-1980s to the 1990s, the municipal government pursued large-scale urban renewal and redevelopment projects. And so the city pushed my grandmother, my mother, and my aunts out of their longtang to construct a six-lane expressway. They were given a total of 4 days to vacate and displaced to the outskirts of the city to a place I visited once in my life. So this family history, coupled with my own experiences of growing up in Flushing, Queens in the 90s until now, have made me acutely aware of how rootedness shapes the political lives and experiences of immigrants, of immigrant women, and their families and their communities. And so my ongoing work in Manhattan's Chinatown seems to weave all of these factors together. My academic research, my art practice, they're all rooted in family and community engagement. And so right now I work closely with the Chinatown Art Brigade, which is a women-led collective of Asian American artists, tenants, and organizers, driven by the fundamental belief that cultural, artistic, and material modes of production have the power to transform our society. I also collaborate with Mei Lung, who at the WOW Project, which is based at 101 Co., which is the oldest continually run store in Manhattan's Chinatown, located at 26 Mott Street. When I first interviewed Mei for my book project, her family was about to sell their Red Brick building, and I offered to bring Mei with me on some of the oral histories I was conducting with some of the neighbors in Chinatown. And from those conversations stemmed the WOW Project. And so I wrote about the beginnings of the WOW Project in the special issue piece, and sort of the work that the WOW Project and Mei Lung is doing as fifth generation owner of 101 Co. At 26 Mott Street, an intergenerational space for community resilience and a space that actively fights around issues of displacement and gentrification. And so I'm going to show a little clip that sort of tells the story better than I can really tell it.
Wing An Wo is the oldest shop in Chinatown, 91 years old this year. It's been in my family for five generations. It started with my great-great-grandfather who came to America as a merchant.
He opened it in the 1890s, and it was originally across the street where it was more of a general store. They also had like medicine. You could go there for like postal service. But then he moved it across the street to a bigger space in the 1920s, which is where we are today.
Back in the day when mother-in-law took over in the mid-60s when her dad passed on.
She wanted to focus on one object, and she found that porcelain was her calling.
And for the past 50 years, my father-in-law and mother-in-law carried this business along and passed it on to us. This picture of all of us gathering here and having meals and going through our routines, opening the store 7 days a week, was a picture that all of us have.
Leaving to go work and live abroad for 3 years, that courage that I had to leave home was rooted in my strong base here in Chinatown and with my family.
She could rely on that memory in her ventures beyond Chinatown. And it brings comfort, safety, and security, and it's predictable.
Myself and like my sister and my other cousins all have full-time jobs, and this was when like I think Mei was still abroad or had just come back. So none of our paths were to take on the store.
Mother-in-law and father-in-law, they're 93 and 87. It got to a point where they were getting too old to carry it on.
When I found out that my grandma and my parents were considering selling the building and giving up the business, it was really upsetting to me, and I didn't want to be so reactive. I wanted to understand where the decision was coming from.
My grandma, I think, didn't want us to be trapped by the store. She saw it as a negative thing at the time.
My family, I think, they didn't really know what to do in the time that we were going through the motions of putting our building on the market, talking to a bidder, and almost signing. They all were kind of frozen.
She was in a fork in the road. She was accepted to grad school. We were on the cusp of selling the business, so there's a lot of conflict and struggle.
I was the only one like jumping up and down, waving my arms like, no, this doesn't have to be something that just happens. And in the end, I didn't want it to be a decision that we regretted. And because we all live in the community, it's like, it would be so painful to walk past the storefront and see something else here instead of our space. At the same time, I had met a woman named Diane Wong, who was starting her dissertation research on the gentrification of Chinatowns in the US. And so after she met me and had my interview, she invited me on other interviews with her. That moment of meeting her and then spending 3 months interviewing different community stakeholders was a turning point for me, because I was able to listen to the stories of the people that make up my community.
Although, you know, small businesses start in small worlds like Chinatown, neighborhoods like this. How do you sustain it is that, you know, you continue for as long as you cannot, and if there's an opportunity for those to return like May, you offer them that option, and if that's not their wish, you move on. That's basically the way of the world. Because for mom and pops to start a business in New York City, a gentrified New York City, is very difficult. Expenses are very high, you don't have much money, and it's great risk.
One point that comes to the forefront of my mind is just all like these hipster locations that are opening up in Chinatown. While they're very trendy, they don't help sustain the Chinatown community.
The visible changes are making people really nervous. I think it's tough. Older generations are stubborn in their ways. They don't see the value in changing the way that they're doing things because it's been working for so many years. And for me, I mean, it is challenging to work in a multi-generational space and to say, no, I think that we should change this, or I think we should use social media, or I think we should get a website, and to sell it to my 86-year-old grandma who is like, I don't know what that means. Just because my grandma's my grandma doesn't mean that I know everything about her. I need to remind her that, hey, do you remember when you were 26 years old and had a lot of energy and were excited to learn and explore? And to also remind her of how she started taking over the business. She reached a similar turning point with her family and the business in 1964, and none of her family members wanted to keep the space, but she was the one who said, no, I want to keep it, I'll take it over. And so we have that relating point, and to figure out the commonalities between our experience is where the generation gap closes, right? But it's just a matter of reminding her and telling her, like, no, I'm here for you. I'm here every day. Don't worry. You know, things like that. So the WOW Project started in May. We had come up with this idea of holding a really informal panel discussion showcasing second-gen, third-gen Chinese-American business owners and asking them about how they see themselves playing a role in this cycle of a changing neighborhood, of gentrification.
We want to make sure that the future of Chinatown is in our hands versus people from the outside coming in. A way to be part of the community is coming to the panels and joining the discussion, sharing their point of views, being an active part of the community, not just a figure who is here because the rent might be cheaper.
Do not put yourself to sleep to cope with the world, because you have feelings, you have passion, you have interests, you have hobbies, you have an opinion about what's going on.
I don't want for us Wing on Wall and the WOW Project to forget that we are a shop in Chinatown, but we also exist in a larger space too, and what that means against a larger context, because our work is more powerful in that way if we're able to connect with other people.
It's about incorporating everyone into the truth about living together, not separate.
Do you want to come out? Poa.
Mr. Haas is going to pick up the stuff before we go.
What time?
Soon.
Okay.
Just want to have you down over there.
Do you want to go do it?
Okay. When are you going to be through?
Almost. You're up next, you know.
That's what you think.
For what's sort of a community archive that's built from inside of a store space can look like. Held conversations around the role of galleries in the gentrification of Chinatown and in New York City. There is a youth internship program, and this photo is of a moving resource cart with flyers, with recipes, things like that, that were pushed throughout the neighborhood over the summer of last year. A Resist, Recycle, Regenerate youth program for women, non-binary youth who have connections to Manhattan's Chinatown. And the program revolves around using the traditional practice of paper making and recycling Lunar New Year confetti back into the community through the art of paper making and printmaking. And they've held sort of workshops for the community that are free of charge and open to all ages. In the Asian American Artist in Residency, so this artist in residency is going into its third year. This is the photo of Emily Mock, who did a residency last year around paper cutting. We've also built relationships with tenants and organizers and small shopkeepers in other Chinatowns, including Seattle, Vancouver, Boston, LA, around issues of displacement and connecting struggles here to conversations that are happening elsewhere, recognizing that the displacement happening here is part of a much larger struggle around dispossession. Last year we held a Homeward Bound series that basically highlights ways to conduct oral histories and what it means to sort of co-create these narratives with community members. This is one of my collaborators, Kay B. Chan, who is a poet and educator based in New York City. And from sort of the stories and the visuals that we've collected from our own work, we ended up curating an exhibit that was held at Pearl River Mart last fall around sort of the changes and resistance happening in different Chinatowns around the world, including Manhattan. And so I'm happy to talk a little bit more about sort of what I argue with this piece, but I'm going to save the time for other contributors. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out, and thank you to Lily and Madeira for thinking of this issue. I remember getting the call for papers from two of my mentors and seeing it and being like, oh my gosh, here it is. Here is the exact space that speaks to many of the things that I'm interested in, because as I was training as an anthropologist and trying to find a home and trying to figure out how to train, it was difficult because too often in academia we exist in silos and
regional studies when the realities of her existence don't fit into those boundaries. And this issue enables all of us to get to explore that and expand and think beyond, which was an amazing opportunity for myself because I'm very interested in getting into the complications of how migration actually exists today, or has existed for many, many years. It's not simply the movement of individuals from home country to host country. People are moving in many different ways. It's not unidirectional, as we all know by now. And so the research that I'm doing is demonstrating the way that people are moving from space to space and how that movement influences their experiences and shapes how they situate themselves in new places. Also, I'm someone who's very interested in the intersection of religion, race, and migration, and that's largely because when we think about the forces of colonialism and the forces of immigration, so much of it was and is structured around race and concerns around morality, right? The justification of colonialism often gets this moral tinge, as well as when we think about immigration here in the United States, and even with the indentured migration that I'm studying, so much was about bringing the right type of person, the right kind of moral individual into these different spaces. And so being able to tease that out through this research has been amazing. For myself, as someone who's been working in New York City now for almost 10 years within the Guyanese community, and for folks who don't know, Guyanese and Trinidadian are individuals who are largely of African and Indian descent, even though when we think of the Caribbean, we tend to think of just the Black Caribbean. And so part of the goal of my larger project is to help us expand what it means to be Caribbean and what it means to be Asian, as well as what it means to be Indian. And so through this project, I've been grateful to get to learn about these modern histories of migration that are in existence and tend to be hidden when we think about contemporary migration to the United States. Asians were moving prior to that post 1965 moment. And for the community that I work with, the Guyanese, who are more commonly known as Indian, has demonstrated as Indo-Caribbean American here in New York City, as well as Indian Caribbean, whatever label the community chooses to understand and chooses to identify as. And so for me, my project is about investigating the history of that movement and the continued impact of that movement for the community here in New York City. What happens to a community that is inheritor of this longer history of migration that continues to inform how the community situates itself in New York City, how it makes sense of the experiences of racialization and racism that they face on a day-to-day basis, as well as informs what type of politics the community engages with as it tries to render itself visible and recognizable to the state government, city government, national government. And so to investigate that for my dissertation, I did a project on looking at the role of Hinduism in the Guyanese community. And the piece that I contributed to this issue is from that project, in which as I was going to different temples and talking to different people, I kept meeting these women artists who were responsible for doing more than just performing their art. They became responsible for performing what is seen as Indianness, both within the Guyanese community and within the larger South Asian American community. And so this paper, which actually started as a gender paper and has developed in the past 7 years to what is in the issue, attempts to excavate the different forces that impact
this community and how the community is sitting between these binaries that seem to define the way that we understand the role of women, that we understand the role of Asian individuals in the quote-unquote modern world. So I thought maybe I would just read the opening parts of this essay and maybe we can have a conversation. As we sat in her cozy, sparsely decorated living room, Ranjitha, a 32-year-old Indo-Caribbean-American singer and vocal teacher, reflected upon the issues we had discussed over the past hour. You know how heavy, copy-heavy these topics are. These are not little things. This is not like, let's feed the homeless and poor and maybe make a dent in that if we get corporate sponsorship. You're talking about ideals and tradition, and I don't know what else to call it, prejudices, paradoxes. In sharing her history in New York City, Ranjitha had framed her experience in terms of what it means to be an Indo-Caribbean American woman in the United States. Her story echoes many I've heard from other Indo-Caribbean American women artists during my field work. Idolized as models of good Hindu women, these artists, dancers of Kathak, and singers of classical Indian music and devotional songs have the difficult task of performing and maintaining the authenticity of the Indianness of the Indo-Caribbean Americans living in the city. As they all vigilantly preserve and pass down the classical Indian arts, they also inhabit the instances of their existence between immigrants and American, West Indian and East Indian, traditional and modern, religious and secular, these women crave to express their polycultural voice and to articulate an Indo-Caribbean American feminism which resolves the tensions between these binaries which impact their experience in New York. To appreciate the contradictions they live, this article investigates these tensions by focusing on the experiences of Ranjitha. As will become apparent, Ranjitha's efforts to voice her polycultural self and realize an Indo-Caribbean and American feminism through her art are thwarted by her community's history of twice migration, first from India to the Caribbean, and then from the Caribbean to New York City. Because this history of twice migration renders their Indianness as less than, this double diaspora community relies upon the authentic performance of classical Indian traditions to claim belonging to the Indian American diaspora and by extension access to the privileges associated with being acknowledged as a model minority in the United States. Tasked with executing such performances of Indianness, Ranjitha and other Indo-Caribbean American women artists embody an ideal of a good Hindu Indian woman akin to the Bhadra Mahila or respectable woman, an ideological construct that dates back to the Indian nationalist movement. Although the Bhadra Mahila is unique to 19th century Bengal, I will highlight in my discussion of recent scholarship how the larger ideology of respectable femininity embodied by the Bhadra Mahila remains a productive lens for scholarship of India and the Indian diaspora through time to examine the intersection of gender, nationalism, and race. In particular, I'll draw upon the scholarship to demonstrate the continued relevance of this figure to the Indo-Caribbean American community in New York City. By considering how this ideology and ideal are present in the experiences of Ranjitha, I will illustrate how Indo-Caribbean American women are central to the Indo-Caribbean American community's claims to Indianness and model minority status in the United States. Such an illustration is critical in appreciating the importance of gender and how Asian diasporas navigate notions of belonging and experiences of racialization in new locations. Also, my focus on Indo-Caribbean American communities highlights the heterogeneity and multiplicity of South Asian America. Further, I will show how this construct of the Bhadra Mahila also presents questions about the prevailing formulation of voice as empowering, suggesting that at times performance is not transformative, but disciplinary.